since 1775,
generations of Americans have fought
for our ideals and our principles.
American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world.
Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen,
soldiers,
sailors,
marines,
airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun
at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged.
This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose.
It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041.
The American Warrior is on the air.
Hi, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're here for another episode of American Warrior. And I tell you, I'm really, really pleased to have our guest here today. It's someone whose voice you will recognize. If we're on TV, you'd certainly recognize his face. He's been a regular guest commentator on 104.1 The Truth. But today he's here to talk about something a little bit different and some things I'd be willing to bet you didn't know about him. And so we're joined in the studio today by one of my favorite people, Frank Antonori.
Man, thanks, Ben. Appreciate that intro.
That went bad, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Well, see, I printed out your bio and all of your medals and awards and stuff, and I figured, look, we only have an hour. I can't get into that.
Yeah, but it's hard to fit 20 years of your life in an hour, yeah.
What made me think of you for today's show was some things in the news that we're not going to talk about, but I wanted to share, tell me about your book.
Well, my A-team was involved in what was, by many opinions, a historic battle in northern Iraq, where you had two small Special Forces A-teams take on a battalion-size Iraqi armor element. And for the first time, we used a Javelin anti-tank missile, which was the first fire-and-forget anti-tank missile used in combat. And we took on a force that, you know, basically outnumbered us almost 10-1, had tanks and armored personnel carriers, and we had fiberglass Humvees. We didn't even have up-armored Humvees, and we caused a lot of damage to them in a short period of time.
Well, now, you framed the picture, right. But let's take a step back here a little bit.
So,
tell us about Frank Antonori. How did you get, you know, we were talking a little bit when you first came in about just sort of the steps you went through in your military career, but when did Frank Antonori, the young man, decide, I'm going to go the military route?
Well, I really wanted to become an electrical engineer, and I wanted to go to Penn State. I was from Pennsylvania, and Penn State was just like the U of A is here to folks that live in southern Arizona. So one of the options was to join the military and get the Army College Fund to be able to pay for college, so you come out without any bills and college loans. But I wanted a high-tech MOS, so I joined the Army to become a nuclear weapons specialist, and it was a high-tech MOS. I'm probably one of the few guys whose recruiter didn't lie to him about what he was going to do when he joined in the Army. But it was really...
Thanks. I'm not going to get any advertised from the recruiters.
No,
Frank.
Recruiters,
okay.
Recruiters, you know, they got a job.
Understood.
Half of them don't even know the job they're recruiting the kid into, so they have to kind of ad lib or read up on it, and some of the stuff isn't always accurate, and you always get some kid that complains that he got sucked into something he didn't really sign up for. That's all horror stories. But, you know, it really was what I expected. A lot of great training, electronics training and stuff, and after I was halfway through AIT, this major from SOCOM came in and said, I'm looking for 5 male volunteers to go to jump school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and then be assigned to a special forces unit at Fort Bragg to be a technical advisor. That sounded cool to me. I'm 18 years old, special forces, Fort Bragg, jumping out of airplanes. Hand went right up. Had no idea that time what I was signing up for, but it was also a good move. Through the training, went down to Fort Benning, got to jump out of airplanes, got assigned to Fort Bragg. They stuck me as a support guy, they call it attachment, if you, for lack of a better word, to the 5th Special Forces Group, 1st Battalion, 5th Group. And I was there to provide technical advice to an A-team that did a mission at the time. It's been declassified now, but at the time it was the Backpack Nuke program called Project Greenlight. And these Greenlight teams were designed to take small nuclear bombs that they carried on their back and plant them in very strategic locations in the Soviet Union and other areas that were sensitive and posed a threat to us if we ever were to go to war and take out large ammunition dumps, airfields, dams, big targets, obviously. Mm-hmm. Nuclear bombs take out pretty big stuff. So I was there to teach the guys how to employ the bomb. I knew all about the bomb. I'd gotten through the training, all the insides and outsides, how it worked, where to stick it to get the best effect, and how to work it. And I hung out with those guys for about a year, and then they have what's called a nuclear surety inspection. They got inspected by the Department of Energy, because it's technically a Department of Energy asset. All the nuclear warheads belong to the DOE. So once these guys got certified, they said, hey, Frank, thanks for helping us. We don't have to do this again for 5 more years. So they shook my hand. They promoted me, made me a specialist.
That's not bad.
Yeah, they promoted me to Spec 4, gave me an Army Commendation Medal, and sent me back to my regular unit, which kind of stunk. it was the regular Army, and anybody knows the soft community is so different. And as a young Spec 4 now, I did not fit in, and I had been sort of spoiled hanging out with the professional soldiers of the United States military, and the Army does a lot of stupid things. Like, they have you paint rocks and then flip them over and paint the other side and dig holes and then fill the hole back in. That's the regular Army. No, that's the regular Army. And I just couldn't deal with the stupidity. So I put in my packet to go Special Forces to get back there as fast as I could, and the rest was history. I went through the course, graduated, and was assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group, the same group that I had been assigned to as a support guy.
Now, I tell you, this, you know, our listeners love to hear stories, and we're going to get into, I just doing my research in your book, Frank, I think one of the most compelling stories of that era and that war. But we also want to educate, and you edumacated me here just this afternoon. Explain Special Forces to our listeners who are civilians and the distinctions there, because I didn't know the way you framed it.
Hollywood has unfortunately distorted the definitions of special operations and special forces. John F. Kennedy signed a presidential order when he created and awarded the Green Beret, as we know it, to the Army Special Forces, and designated them as the only special forces unit in the United States military. So the only unit in the United States military, and that's Navy, Air Force, whatever, that is special forces, is the Army Special Forces, otherwise known as the Green Berets. The rest of the units, whether it's the SEALs or the pararescue guys or the Rangers, or they're special operations. They're special operators, but they're not special forces. And Special Forces was set up to specifically do a unique mission that a lot of those other units don't do, and that mission is insurgency and counterinsurgency. We go into countries, we train them either to defend themselves or we train the rebel elements to help overthrow a government that ain't so friendly to the United States. So we had a unique mission. John Kennedy, President Kennedy, was instrumental in creating what is now known as the modern Special Forces, and he holds a special place in everybody's heart in Special Forces, because the only unit that has been awarded an actual headgear has been the Army.
Right.
Everybody else wears a hat, but the Green Beret is an award. It is an award that is given to you upon successful completion, and it is an award that was presented by the President of the United States. So it's one of the few nostalgic items that you have in the military, and that's the Green Beret. It's a big deal. It really is.
So the Green Beret is made famous in the John Wayne movie, and those are special forces.
That's right.
So when I say Green Beret, I'm saying Special Forces, or has that changed even now?
No, they're almost synonymous. There was a time when there was a little heartburn. Guys didn't want to be called a hat. You know, oh, I'm not a hat. You know, that's a hat.
Right.
I'm a Special Forces soldier. But again, it's become so synonymous in the blurring of what Special Forces is. When you say Green Beret, everybody knows exactly what that is. They know Green Berets are like John Wayne and all the guys you see in those special Hollywood movies, some that aren't so accurate. But that's the way it is.
Well, thanks for enlightening me. Yeah. Folks, stick around. We'll be right back, and we're going to really get into the meat, if I may use that word, of things. The Battle of Debeka Pass, which is just, as I mentioned to Frank earlier, I think it's one of the most compelling stories in our military history. We're joined in studio with Frank Antonori. Give us a call. The phone lines are open, 751-1041. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
We're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined in studio with Special Forces, retired.
Retired,
Special Force actually retired.
Yeah, I'm coming up on my 10-year.
Like a Marine.
10-year anniversary of being out of the military here.
So you joined when you were 12?
No, 18. Oh, 18 yeah, years. Yeah. I'm 48, so yeah, so it's unbelievable already. You know, wow. 30 years ago, I joined the Army, and it's been hard to believe it's been that long of a time.
This shy, humble guy in the studio, folks, Frank Antonori, has also served our community, still active in the community and politics. But we're not here to talk about politics today, sure. Frank. We're here to talk about the military. And I got to tell you, honestly, you know, you read your bio, the intro to your book, and folks can still get that on Amazon, I assume. And the name of the book again is
Roughneck 9-1, An Extraordinary Story of a Special Forces A-Team at War.
And as you go through the bio, I see Debeka Pass, see Anaconda, I see Mujahideen.
Yeah.
I mean, your resume reads like a movie.
If you join the Special Forces, you get to go all over the world and meet and do all sorts of interesting things with a lot of interesting people. When I graduated from the Special Forces Q course, and I was assigned to the 5th Special Forces Group at that time, they had just moved the 5th Special Forces Group from Fort Bragg to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, along with the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, and put them there. And I was a single guy. I wasn't married. So I go walking in, and I report in, and my sergeant major says, Antonori, you married or single? And I go, I'm single, sergeant. Good. Don't unpack. You know, we got something. All the married guys were looking for housing and trying to get their family settled, and the single guys that were going to live in the barracks, he said, I need you. There's a mission coming down. We're shorthanded. I'm going to assign you to an A-team that needs a medic to go on this mission. They need a medic bad, and you're going. And it wasn't like, you know, that's the Army. It's like, can I think about it?
It's not a democracy, no.
Right. So I said, oh, Roger, that's our major. I look forward to it. Where are we going? Classified, can't talk about it. You got to go get briefed. So I go into the briefing, and the team leader, the captain of the team, sits me down, and he says, hey, sir, I was a buck sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Rob, just that's the lowest rank you can have in Special Forces. So I go in there, and he says, hey, I'm glad you're here. We need a medic. We're getting ready to go to Pakistan. I'm like, oh, wow, Pakistan, cool. And he says, well, I'll brief you the rest when we get to Washington, D.C. We got to go to D.C. We get a briefing from up in D.C., and then we're going to go over there. So we go up to Washington, D.C., and we get briefed by the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they tell us that we're part of a highly classified operation to train and equip the Mujahideen to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And I'm like, wow, this is what I joined for. This is what Special Forces is all about, right? So they then tell us we have to have our identity stripped. We can't carry anything that resembles the U.S. military. We were allowed to grow our hair really long and grow beards so we didn't look like Americans. And we were posing as aid workers. Like the nickname we give them was the Dirty Foot Crowd because they all wear like sandals
right.
and stuff. So and try to look like a Peace Corps worker, U.S. aid worker. Just we never said we were Peace Corps because they get mad.
Okay, just stop right there because I want to take the moment just to relish picturing Frank Antonori as a Peace Corps worker.
Well, Special Forces is basically the Peace Corps with guns. I mean, we do go. We provide a lot of humanitarian aid, and we set up water and food safe sources for and a lot of. We actually do that. And as a medic, I treated domestic animals and cows and chickens and goats and stuff, you know, to help people. It's a unique organization.
A special moment for me because I think your statement, Peace Corps with guns, is going to get me my first hate mail here on American Warrior Radio.
You'll probably have some former, there's probably a lot of people that were in the Peace Corps here and they don't want that announcement. But anyways, so we get read in on the program and then we go and get the colonel that was in charge of it from the Army side says, and you're going to be working with the CIA. Don't trust those guys. They'll leave you hanging. They're this and that and all that. So it's really okay, yes, sir. So then they take us over to Langley, and the CIA reads us in on the project because they were leading it.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically said, hey, if the DIA guys told you anything, don't, because they're like the same competition, right? Don't believe them. They're full of baloney. We're going to take care of you. They lie to everybody that comes there. It was really kind of funny. So they gave us diplomatic passports, and our cover was that we were part of an assessment team to do health and welfare for embassies and consulates overseas. So we were supposed to go to, like, the embassy in Islamabad, the consulate in Peshawar and Karachi and all these places. We never got there.
But, I mean, are you given a cover story, a script you have to memorize in case you... Okay.
Yep. So they give you a passport. We had black diplomatic passports, the whole nine yards. They made us look like we worked for the State Department. So we get on the airplanes. What was really interesting, they had us get hotel rooms at an embassy suites in Virginia under our real names And we basically stayed at these embassy suites for the entire 3 months. I lived in a hotel room in Virginia the whole time.
Oh, I get it. You weren't actually checked in.
I never
in,
left
but,
the country.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And every day some CIA guy would go in and muss up the room and walk. I'm not kidding. And walk out. So yeah. So there was this cover that we were doing some sort of training. We were up there for training. We weren't really involved with this mm-hmm. operation in Afghanistan. So we get on the plane. We fly to Pakistan. We land in Islamabad. The station chief there from the American embassy welcomes us in, says, hey, you guys, we got about 2 weeks before we do the rotation. We're going to take you out to Peshawar, set you up at the warehouse with our guys there. So we get there, we get all equipped up with all these non-U.S. gear, radios are not U.S. All mm-hmm. we had British mm-hmm. radios and Chinese this and all sorts. It was really cool. And then they dressed us again like Peace Corps workers, and they brought these trucks in, and they filled the bottoms of these. You've seen these big Jenga trucks, they call
sure,
them. They're unbelievable.
Sure.
So we filled the bottom of the truck with weapons and ammunition, and then filled the rest of it with food. And it was stacked like a mile high, huge. So we get in there, and then the driver for my truck was a Pakistani ISI agent. They're CIA guys, mm-hmm. who are not very good guys, by the way. They helped the Taliban. Anyways, so they take us down. We go through the Khyber Pass, which is the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. At the time, the communist regime of Najibullah was in charge of Afghanistan. He was the guy that brought the Russians in. And the guard, you know, basically start shaking us down, and you know, my ISI guy just pulls out some rupees, and they call it bakshish, is the for give me some money, bribe me, basically. And they're very blatant about it. So we slipped them what was basically like $50, which over there is probably like $500.
Right.
And the guy just waved us through, and he had no idea what he was doing. He's just waving through everything from Chinese Dishka 51 caliber machine guns to AKs to Stinger missiles. And he's just waving us through, and the convoy goes up. There was a refugee camp that we went up and dropped the food off, and we were actually bringing food to refugees because the Pakistanis sealed the border, would not let the Afghans cross. So there was a huge, and you've seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War.
Yeah.
And it's exactly like that. They did a pretty good job. The camp, as far as you can see, little makeshift tents, people just all over. And we delivered this food to them, and then we pulled out from the camp, went down the road about 3-4 miles, and the rest of the stuff was unloaded. A bunch of guys come out of the woods, grabbed all the stuff and ran back up in the woods, and I jumped out of the truck, ran with them, and then my Special Forces counterpart from another A-team that was there come out of the woods. We did a quick handshake, and he jumped in the truck and drove back. So when they went back through the gate, it was just another white guy. So it looked like a white guy went in, and a white guy came
wow.
out. So it was so when they go back through, the guards just, you know, we all look alike, right, over there. So it didn't really, they couldn't tell that we were actually swapping guys out. So I then spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan training the Mujahideen on what they needed to do to fight the Russians. It was just, and I did two more rotations after that. I came 3 weeks, we came back out. I'd hang out by the pool at the embassy in Islamabad for 3 weeks and go out to Peshawar, and the process would start all over again. So I did that 3 times. Unbelievable that a few years later I would be back over there fighting the other
several
way.
Several times, yeah.
The other way around. It was just a remarkable time. And I got to meet Charlie Wilson. I met him twice, actually, once at a classified debriefing we did for his committee in Congress. And I never knew the guy was a Democrat. Oh, you want to get into politics, but he was just a staunch anti-communist that you just assumed he was Republican. But the guy was actually a liberal Democrat. And then I met him after he'd already gotten out of office, Duncan Hunter, when we got back from Anaconda. My team was asked to come up to Washington again and provide information to the House Armed Services Committee. And then after that, they held a reception for us. And Duncan Hunter said, hey, Sergeant Anthony, have you ever met Charlie Wilson? And I was like, well, as a matter of fact, Congressman, yes, I have. And he's like, really? Where'd you meet him before? And I said, well, I don't know if it's
when I was in the Peace Corps.
They're classified yet. But, and then sure enough, you know, he pretended like he remembered me. I seriously doubt he did. But, you know, he's, oh, I remember you guys. Oh, it's good to see you again. But and he died, unfortunately, about 2 years after that, poor guy. But yeah, I got to meet him. He led a hard life. If you saw the movie, you'd know. You know, I didn't know any of that until I saw the movie. I was like astonished.
Now,
when I saw that,
one of the central themes in that movie, in Charlie Wilson's War, which I really enjoy, I love that movie. But you're training the Mujahideen to operate the Stinger missiles.
Right.
Did you actually participate in that part of it? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's been declassified.
Okay.
I actually ended up getting a medal from Les Aspin and Bill Clinton because at the time, you know, Clinton wasn't even in office, but the mission wasn't declassified until halfway through the Clinton administration. Then we all got to go to D.C. and Les Aspin gave us defense meritorious service medals for for doing this operation. But anyways, the Mujahideen were being trained as a cohesive unit, just like a regular unit. And you had medics, you had machine gunners, and then we had guys that were the stinger gunners. I was a medic, and I was trained in the medics and the combat lifesavers. The other guys that were with me were weapons guys, and they were trained in the Dishka, which is a 51 caliber mm-hmm. machine gun, and then the stinger stuff. I was there with them. I wasn't exactly doing the stinger training. But I did get to see them shoot two Stinger missiles at a helicopter from about 5 miles away. You could see the, and they were successful. It was impressive to watch, and they did a heck of a job of just shredding the Soviet machine over there. And it was just a handful of insurgents that were well equipped and well trained by us at the time, and they did some damage.
Well, the reason I'm bringing that up is I just saw in the news the Navy now is looking for someone to produce basically fake missiles so that we can sure. actually train our pilots by shooting these fake missiles. And you know, as a civilian, it just never strikes me these things are
that
expensive.
Is a freaky thing to propose, and I don't know what the Navy's thinking. You know, that's a like a $200-300 million airplane, and you want to shoot a missile at it. I know it's supposed to run out of gas before it hits it, but it's still a freaky proposition.
Well, I
have a live missile.
One of my previous guests, a Doolittle Raider, talked about the difference between engineers and pilots, and I was going to add that. But listen, Frank, when we come back, I want to talk more about this Battle of Debeka Pass. Folks, we've got a real American hero here in the studio. If you'd like to call, 751-1041 is our phone number. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back with some more compelling, compelling stories of American warriors here on American Warrior Radio.
Who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
We're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined in the studio by retired Special Forces
Sergeant.
Sergeant.
Right.
Operator. I was going to say operator, but now you're going to confuse people. Frank Antonori.
Ground pounder.
Local guy, Frank Antonori. Frank, we've only got about 30 minutes left, folks.
Sure.
If you have a question or a comment, want to talk to a real hero, give us a call. 751-1041. We're live in the studio today. Frank, I really like to focus about this, the Battle of Debeka Pass, because I think not only is the story itself compelling, but it was really a transition is not the right word, but that was something that, from what I've read, the tactics and the tools that your team used there really have transformed and supported where Special Forces are going from here. So start off by just painting the picture for us. What is the situation? There's, you and 30 others
right.
and 80 insurgents against
a couple hundred Iraqis, and let me just back you up. The whole reason we were in there was the original attack plan for Iraq was coming in through Turkey. The 4th mm-hmm. Infantry Division was supposed to go through, and then at the last minutes, the Turkish parliament voted no and said no. The Iraqis found this out, and they were starting to withdraw their elite units. They had two Republican Guard units and a bunch of their top infantry and armor units in the north because they thought that's where the main assault, which was being telegraphed on CNN, was going to come from, right? So when the Turks said no, what was happening was the Iraqis started to pull those units out from the north and bring them south of Baghdad. And at the time, General Tommy Franks, who's the CENTCOM commander, said, no, we got to keep those guys busy. So he called at the time Colonel Cleveland, who's now a 3-star general down in SOCOM. But Colonel Cleveland, he said, you got to keep them busy. He goes, I want you to take your Green Berets into northern Iraq and just pick fights with these Iraqis all day long so that they can't withdraw these units. And we keep them pinned down up there. So because you had 13 divisions up north. And imagine, and you had about 8 divisions down south.
Now, and for civilians, explain, a division is how many troops?
A Soviet organization, it's about 7,000 or 8,000 troops.
Per division. Okay.
So if you, and the Iraqis were modeled after the Soviet model. So if you think about it, there was like 7 divisions in the south, you know, 13 divisions in the north. So 2/3 of the Iraqi force was in northern Iraq. And they were going to pull all these guys. Imagine our poor guys, the Marines uh-huh. and the guys coming up from the south would have encountered 3 times the size of an enemy force that they normally, and they would have gone against a moderate trained unit and against some of the best trained units in the Iraqi army. So our job was to basically go into northern Iraq, drive around behind enemy lines, pick fights with the Iraqis, and keep them pinned down so that they thought there was a credible threat up there, and they couldn't withdraw their forces and give our guys coming up from the south a hard time. So that was our job. And when you walk into a team room and brief a Special Forces A team that your mission is going to be to go into enemy territory and just pick fights with the enemy, you get a lot
were thrilled, right?
You get a lot of excited guys.
Sure.
And so that's what we did. So we drove into northern – well, we were flown in by a C-130 in the dark of night, landed on a paved highway. We're offloaded on a highway, and that was the Air Force Special Operations Wing brought us in. Those guys, awesome pilots, awesome crew. We were literally in the dark of the night, 3 in the morning, landed on a imagine landing on I-10, okay, in the middle of the night with no lights, in the dark. You went under night vision goggles, landing I-10, dropping the ramp while the airplane was still moving, driving vehicles with Special Forces off, and then turning that plane around 180 degrees and taking back off again. And they did that in like 3 minutes. And it was just a phenomenal thing. And they dropped us off. And then we were there in northern Iraq. We started driving around looking for Iraqis and picking fights. And on this particular day, we were told that there was a large Iraqi armor unit in this valley and that we were going to pick a position high on a ridgeline and we were going to start shelling the living snot out of these guys. Well, we get up on the ridgeline. We didn't see any armor. But below us was Highway 2, the second largest highway in Iraq. Highway 1 ran north and south, Highway 2 east and west. And we're like, wow, we can't let all these trucks, and it was trucks and material, you know, supply trucks and stuff. So we drove down there, and we started firing up these vehicles with 50 cals and shooting them up. And we had, it was two A-teams and then a Kurdish Peshmerga unit that was with us, about 80 guys, with another A-team from the 10th Special Forces Group, but it was a half a team, really. It was like five guys that were attached to them, and they were there as sort of the main effort. We were there to support them. We weren't supposed to be part of the main effort, but, you know, you get really excited when you see a lot of targets running around. So we run down this hill, get close enough to fire these vehicles up with our 50 cals, and we did that for about 3-4 hours until they, I guess, the word got back to the Iraqis, and they got a little upset that we were shooting up their lunch and dinner and all their
Now, were you, based on my research, and I know this is typically there's some things you can talk about, there's some things you can't, but I mean, basically, you're sitting up on the hill, and there was some discussion about whether you should go down to the juncture or not, and someone said, look, I didn't come to Iraq to watch these guys just drive by all day.
The inner discussions of the teams are awesome, because Special Forces A teams don't have the typical rank structure. I mean, you have a team leader, a captain, that basically makes the final decision, but he gets input from the rest of the guys, and the majority of the operators on that team have 5, 10, 15 years of Special Forces experience. The captains usually only have 2 or 3 years. They're young guys, and they're only there for 4, and then they move on. So Captain Wright would always ask us. He'd say, hey, what do you guys think? And we're like, you know, hey, sir, look at all that. You know, those are all trucks full of ammo and food and beans and bullets, and we shouldn't be letting them drive by us to go equip units somewhere else to cause trouble for somebody. We should be smoking these guys. So we fired the first couple bursts of machine guns, and contrary to what you see in Hollywood, it is very hard to hit a vehicle going 50 miles an hour down the highway with a 50 cal machine gun. It is not easy from about 1,400 meters away, 1,200 meters away. We were like a half a mile away. So we said, oh, we're too far away. We need to drive closer. So we drive down the hill, get about 700-800 yards away, and then at that point we were very successful in being able to engage these and take these vehicles down. And then eventually the traffic got to the point where we drove down to the very intersection itself in the middle of this highway and shut down the whole highway and cut it down. And any vehicle that came down, we fired up and would not let it go past.
And then there's some smoke, and next thing you know, you got some tanks coming through the smoke.
Yeah, and the Iraqis didn't like that again. So we're sitting there in the middle of this intersection, and then my commo guy, Andy Pizzella from New York, a good paisan, was sitting up in the turret behind the machine gun, and he starts banging on the roof of the Humvee, and I'm sitting in the Humvee, and he's yelling, tanks, 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 and I'm like, where do you see tanks? And Andy looks out, and I could just see the armored personnel carriers breaking out and spreading out abreast to come on this full-fledged, and they got smoke generators, they're throwing smoke.
Mm-hmm.
So we opened up on these APCs with our 40-millimeter grenade launchers and our machine guns, and Jason Brown, who became the hero of this battle, pulls the Javelin anti-tank missile out, and he sits out in the middle of the road, and he's getting set up. And then in true Soviet style, when you attack an infantry unit, they then dig in, and then they allow big armor to come through. So as soon as we started firing up the APCs, they then allowed the main battle tanks, which were T-55 Russian-made tanks, that then passed through these APCs and started shooting at us with their 100-millimeter guns. And
now, can you effectively engage an APC with a 50 caliber, or is that...
You could. We had armor-piercing rounds, and it could cause a lot of damage. Now, tanks, it bounces right
off.
Sure. Right, but APCs, you can punch holes in APCs with the 50 cal. It was designed to pierce armor. And we were using armor-piercing incendiary rounds. So, but, you know, the big tanks came through, and I just remember, I'll never forget it. It is seared in my memory, and I was about 800 yards from an Iraqi tank, which in combat is too close to, to a tank.
A little bit.
And I remember seeing the flash of the main gun going off, and in a split second, I heard the round go by me, which felt like it was 50 feet off my shoulder, and then it impacted the ground right behind us.
Wow.
At that moment, it was, we're in big trouble here. We're out in the middle of the open. We got tanks blazing 100-millimeter shells at us. So it was time to run. And everybody says, well, you know, special forces don't run. Yeah, we run. We like to fight again another day. None of us want to make widows out of our wives. The tactical maneuver is called withdrawing and basically moving it back in position and fighting withdrawal. So we grabbed our stuff, went back up the hill, found some defendable terrain, and then unleashed what has now been known as probably one of the most brutal 35 minutes of fighting of the modern Iraq war. And we brought all these Javelin missiles out, and in 35 minutes we eliminated probably 75% of the armor on the battlefield, and it was just a phenomenal thing to see.
And I'd like to emphasize that, because in my interviews and talking with folks in our military, two of our key advantages are not only our technology, but the training of our troops.
Yeah.
And this is, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is one of the first times this new weapon had been employed in combat. And you guys are picking off armored personnel carriers, troop trucks, tanks.
Right.
Was there any sort of discussion afterwards? I mean, the Iraqis had to be pretty surprised that this was taking off.
We actually saw, and I kind of talk about it in the book, Iraqis jumping out of their vehicles, ripping the camouflage nets off the back of their tanks and throwing the camouflage nets over the tanks because they thought they were being hit by aircraft.
Okay.
They had no conceivable idea, because they're thinking RPGs, right?
Mm-hmm,
RPGs,
mm-hmm.
You're really close, you know, a couple hundred yards away from a tank. You see the guy pop up. You see the RPG. It's a straight, direct line of sight. The Javelin isn't. The Javelin actually goes up, flies at 1,500 feet, looks for the tank, and then comes what's called a top-down and goes through the top of the turret into the tank. So they were thinking that was an airplane dropping them. They had no idea it was us, and they were so confused, and it caused such a disarray for them that, again, we just picked them off one by one, vehicle after vehicle. As the Javelin would hit an APC, the injured and disoriented infantry would come spilling out the back, and then the guys with the 50 cals would chop them up with the 50 cals. Nobody made it out of there. It was a brutal 35-minute battle.
And so our listeners, really, if they haven't read your book or read about this battle, so they understand the scope of this, literally, you guys, I mean, just in numbers, you're outnumbered, what, 20-1, 50-1, 30-1?
Yeah, there were 32 of us, and there were about 300 Iraqis, so it was 10-1.
And they had tanks.
And they had tanks with 100-millimeter main guns, and we had Humvees, and they were fiberglass Humvees. We had actually taken the doors off them. There weren't even doors on these things, because
mm-hmm.
we needed to get them as light as possible to get in the C-130 so we can carry as much ammo as we could and fuel. So they were heavily loaded down with fuel and ammunition, no armor whatsoever. And one hit from one of these, and I'd have been a flash of light, and that'd have been it. And I'd have been a gravestone in some cemetery somewhere. So, you know, God that day took care of us. And it's a miracle we came out of there practically unscathed. I just,
Frank,
to this day, can't believe it.
I tell you, we've got one more segment after this break, but I want to talk about, I think it's the first time I've heard or read the phrase Javelin Ace.
Right.
Is that, talk about kind of the follow-up to that battle. And, you know, one thing in your book that I read that just really struck me, I mean, it's war. People get hurt and things get broken. But there was a scene that you observed where some of the Iraqis were attempting to surrender.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to maybe get into that. Folks really understand the different facets of what you all were involved with over there. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We've got one more segment with Frank Antonori. If you want to give us a call, 751-1041. We'll be right back on American Warrior.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth. And we
lit up. We're back, folks. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Frank Antonori, retired Special Forces operator. Very engaged in the community all around. Truly, Frank, and I mean this honestly, I've known you in other areas, but truly an American hero. Thank you so much for your service to our country.
It was an honor to serve this country, and had I not gotten hurt, I probably would have just been about ready to retire. In 30 years, they'll push you out at 30, whether you want to or not. But, yeah, I miss it. I miss the military. I mean, I really do. It was a way of life, and the guys I served with were the best that the country could bring to the battle. I mean, you stop and think about it. You're less than 1%. If you want to talk about the true 1%ers, guys that I served with were the true 1%ers. I mean, you know, we went through, you know, basic training, AIT, training for this, training for that. There were multiple times you volunteered to go do this job. And then the amount of training, the average training is about 2 years, and most of the guys wash out during that training.
Wow.
My class started with 97 guys, my medic class, and six of us graduated. And then we were only about halfway through the training at that point. Mm-hmm. And it's an unbelievable unit to be a part of. And the guys were just, you know, I served with some of the best men in the world.
Well, thank you. We've got a caller who wants to talk about it. Keith, you've called American Warrior. Keith, what's your comment or your question?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'd like to thank you both for what you do. Service to your country, yes, in the military. That's my entire family. I just got back from Arlington, burying my dad.
Mm.
He's one of six family members there.
Mm. Well, God bless you, Keith, and our condolences.
And I think that people really need to take that trip to D.C. and spend the time to look at the monuments and understand how many great men have given their lives for this country. And it's come down to this for me is we need to let people know what honor really means again.
Yeah. Keith, I think you're spot on. And again, our condolences and thank you for your call. Thanks for listening to American Warrior. I know, Frank, you're now third generation Antonori's, correct, going to the service?
I grew up down the street from my Uncle Gino, great Uncle Gino, who had received the Medal of Honor in World War II. And he had survived. And, you know, became sort of a mentor to me. And then he passed away when I got back from Afghanistan in 2002. I got to see him, unfortunately, just a month before he passed away. But my dad was an infantryman. He was a 106 recoilless rifle gunner. And, you know, I joined the Special Forces. And then 3 weeks ago, my youngest son, Brody, who turned 18, joined the Army. And he's going to be a cavalry scout. He leaves in September for basic training. So he gets to hang out over the summer and milk off his mom and I. For one more summer, but
hey,
but then he's
come on, you got a good job.
Oh yeah, he's going to be a cavalry scout. Then he eventually may even follow in my footsteps. So I hope he does. And you know, he's a sharp kid. He played football at Empire High School over there in Vail, and he's very athletic. He runs track. He's in good shape, and he's a perfect guy to be a CAF scout.
Well, and so, let me just say, I wanted to clarify something. Keith, thank you. I never served in the military, and because guys like you, Frank, and others have, and that's why I support those who do, because I never had to do it. We won't even talk about what a mess I would have been in the military. But Keith also...
They'd have straightened you
out. They would have straightened me out.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, that's the one thing the military, you can honestly say, if you take a kid that's got problems and you put him, you want to put him somewhere...
What are you saying, Frank?
No, I'm just saying, you hear all these wonderful stories about these kids that, you know, have issues and whatnot, and they put them in the military and it straightens them out and they turn into great young men.
And
that's what the military does. Whether it's Marine Corps, Army, Air Force, it doesn't matter. They give you responsibility, they give you focus, and they give you a trade or a skill that you could take with you into the civilian sector when you get out of the military.
And I tell you, big picture, I know we're not going to talk politics here today, but Keith also touched on something, and there was a particular episode in this at the Battle of Debeka Pass that we're talking about that reminds me that I think folks so often, I don't know what it is, but they don't understand there is evil in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Period. End of discussion.
Unfortunately seen a lot of it.
Tell us about that particular thing you witnessed there during the battle
So if people remember back during Desert Storm, the thousands and thousands of Iraqi soldiers that surrendered, mm-hmm. and basically, mm-hmm. you know, Saddam lost in his mind, the war because his guys were cowards and they quit. So this time he put what we were told through the intelligence community were enforcers within these units to stop guys from surrendering. And he basically said, look, if you try to surrender, we're going to shoot you for desertion. And we'd been hearing about these rumors, and there's the enforcers. Well, after we just slammed these guys, I mean, you're talking about a battle that was very lopsided, and we took the wind out of their sails. A lot of them just said, uncle.
Right.
They pulled white flags out. They stood up in the middle of the road with their hands in the air, and they were all standing there. And we started having this discussion. So, hey, what are we going to do with these guys? You know, we're not equipped to handle, you know, 50, 60 POWs here, right? So we're talking with the Kurds. We're talking. And all of a sudden, somebody starts screaming and yelling. And I'm like, what's going on? They're like, they're shooting them. They're shooting them. And I pick my head up over the hill to look down into the intersection, and there's six guys wearing the white, the dish dash, the robes, with AKs mowing down right in front of us all these Iraqi soldiers.
Who were trying to surrender.
They were trying to surrender. They were killing them. And there was a big SUV in the middle of the intersection, and they were just, they had their AKs out, and they were just shooting all these guys right in front of us. And they killed all these Iraqi soldiers that were trying to surrender. Well, our Air Force TAC-P, we had a TAC Air Force guy with us, and he got on the radio, and we still had an F-18 above us.
Mm-hmm.
And my warrant officer, Marty McKenna, said, put a paveway in them. And a paveway is a laser guided bomb, actually made here in Tucson, Arizona. Anyways, Marty says, put a paveway in them, because they were just killing these guys.
Yeah.
So, Jake, my Air Force guy, swung the soft lam. It's a laser designator around, put that laser right on that white SUV in that intersection, got that F-18 to do a drop, and that paveway bomb came in, and we watched it smack. There's a huge explosion, cloud of dust, and then when the smoke cleared, it was like somebody took an eraser and just wipe that intersection clean, and those six guys got what they deserve. They're not on this planet anymore because, we took them out.
Immediate and simple justice.
Justice. And what they did was, you know, a war crime. I mean, that is a war crime.
Yeah.
They were murdering their own troops right in front of us. It was just unbelievable to watch.
What, coming back to the Javelin and just the you said, you know, the lopsided battle. On paper, it looked lopsided the other way going into it. But how did that change, or what things do you see coming now as far as the way we shift using special forces and how important they will be in the battles of the future?
What that conflict solidified to the Defense Department and to the Army planners and even the Air Force and Navy planners was that technology and training trumps numbers.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you can take a small, light force that's well-trained and well-equipped and take on a larger force from a country that may not put the investment into their military that we put into our military. And that's bodies, that's time, and that's dollars. That's our investment in this country. A lot of the countries don't do that. So we have a huge advantage over countries that don't see the importance of investing in their defense. And then some have different philosophies. Some believe in the numbers. You know, the Russians for years and years said, you know, we have 50 tanks for every one American tank. Yeah, well, that one American tank's got 50 rounds in it, and he will shoot all 50 Russian tanks before he runs out of ammo and you take this poor guy out. But that was the mentality. So the smart weapons, the training, the tactics came all together in that one point in place and time. And after that battle, I went around the country, and my team leader and I, Captain Wright, talked to infantry commanders, armor commanders at Fort Benning, Georgia, at Fort Bliss, Texas, at Fort Hood, Texas, and, you know, basically showed our battle. And it was basically a change of mindset where now you don't have, it used to be you have to have a 3-to-1 advantage to attack an enemy. They'd say, if you're going to go after an enemy, if they got 100, you need 300 guys. But now we don't need that. You can take a small light force, precision guided weapons, and what we call joint effects, where you got guys on the ground, you got Air Force guys or Navy guys up in the sky, bringing in precision weapons, putting them where you want them, and you can cause probably the equivalent of a battalion's worth of firepower, and we basically call combat power, with basically a platoon or company size element now. So you don't need that battalion. You could bring that same amount of combat power when you apply the joint effects, where you have bombers, you have fighters, and you've got artillery, you've got Apache helicopters, and you got some guy on the ground with a designator and a GPS lasing and shooting targets, and it's changed the way we do warfare.
Now, I know our listeners are friendly crowd to the military. Sure. I think you can assume that, but checking the data on who logs in and listens to the podcast, we've got people logging in from all over the world. I want to hopefully maybe Washington. I want to emphasize it's not just the tools, but it's the training. Because correct me if I'm wrong, you fired 19 javelins that day,
right.
Destroyed 17 targets,
right.
But neither you nor yourself took out a tank,
right,
with
and
a javelin
an APC,
and
right.
an APC.
Yeah.
But neither you nor anyone on your team had actually ever fired that weapon.
Yeah.
In combat.
That's
before,
right.
Or in real practice.
They're very expensive.
Yeah.
Right? So the Army doesn't shoot them like bullets because
right.
It's like $100,000 every time you squeeze the trigger. So they get a little compared to like 20 cents when you squeeze an M16 round. So they developed, the guys that built that missile and designed that missile developed a video game training system to go train on that you actually use the actual missile, but it's a fake one and you're looking through the clue and it's plugged into a game and it looks like you're on a real life battlefield. And we spent a couple hours each training at the 82nd Airborne Division's javelin training system, which is right down the street from us.
Mm-hmm.
So the 82nd Airborne guys were nice enough to let us use their trainer to train up on this brand new weapon that had never been used before. And we're all sitting there all skeptical. It's like a video game. This ain't going to work. But, man, it worked. It worked
right, at
exactly,
that point, you didn't have much choice.
It worked
just like,
exactly
hey.
Like it was in the video game. And the training was so realistic that when we were on the battlefield, I literally couldn't tell the difference.
Wow.
I mean, I'm looking through the actual viewer of this javelin, and I am seeing the same thing I saw back at Fort Bragg when we were training. It was that exact same image, and that training came in handy. It was a great, great weapon system.
Well, Frank, again, thank you for your service. I'd like to have you back sometime.
Sure.
We just didn't have enough time to tell all the stories. But what, again, just in the couple minutes we have left, looking forward, what, as someone with experience on the military side, as someone still engaged on the technology side, what do you see coming down the line? What do folks need to think about?
We got a great future for this country as long as we continue to invest in our people and our technology. And no one could match us at this point. I'm worried that if it continues to go the direction and we see the cuts we're seeing, that it's going to hurt our country's defense. And we got to keep mindful of that.
Anything else you'd like to share with our folks? They can get you the name of the book.
Roughneck91. And you can go on Amazon or any place you can go. Barnes & Noble, they got it. So Roughneck91.
Hey, how many kids have you got?
Two boys. So
buy the book, folks. Frank needs a little bit of money. Hey, come back next week on American Warrior starting at noon. We will have Thunderbird 5, one of the solo pilots for the Thunderbirds. They'll be performing here at the open house here in Tucson. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Stick around. We've got a great Daily Mail episode coming right up. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Thanks to Frank Antonori and all those who serve our country.